Hey, before we start this episode with author Josh Malerman, we want to say how glad we are that you're listening, but also how glad we are that this podcast became a reality thanks to the friends of the Ferndale Library. If you enjoy this episode with the originator of Bird Box, then consider donating or even joining the friends at ferndalefriends.org. Hello, and thanks for clicking play on a podcast about a library. You're listening to A Little Too Quiet, the Ferndale Library podcast, brought to you by the friends of the Ferndale Library. I'm Jeff Milo, and I'm here with producer Kelly Bennett inside the Ferndale Library, a mile north of Detroit. And our guest today is author Josh Malerman, the mind behind Bird Box. It's a hit Netflix film, of course, but it started out as a book that came out 5 years ago. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Josh's experiences in libraries, what he's been working on lately, and the pressure of keeping everyone scared. Josh, welcome to the podcast.
Hi. I love that song, by the way, that introduction.
Oh, yeah. You know, we should probably say that's created by a local musician.
His name is
John Duffy of the analog synth duo Pato y Pato made that up for us.
Man, I love that. I may have to meet this guy.
You should. He'll be actually, he's going to be playing at the library because we have concerts here in this Ferndale Library, of course. So musicians are constantly in this building. Like yourself, you're a musician.
Yeah. And have played in this library and done a reading in this library.
Oh, man. Can't wait to get to that. So welcome, everyone, to the podcast. This is A Little Too Quiet, and I should run down a little bit of Josh's biography because, yes, he's an author, published author, with several books that were released in a flurry over the last 6 years, really. Starting with Bird Box, Your Baby, and followed up by lots of others like Black Mad Wheel, and Unbury Carol, and A House at the Bottom of a Lake, and very recently, Inspection.
God, it's weird that's recent. That feels so long ago now. When you're on like the path of releasing like two books a year, so typically for the last few years, in October would be the second book each year that I've released, but this year we're not because of Mallory, which is coming out next year, next summer. And Inspection feels like ages ago.
Right.
It's like 6 months ago or something.
Right. And for fans of the film Bird Box who probably went back and discovered the book Bird Box, Josh buried the lead right there and mentioned a book called Mallory. What's Mallory?
Mallory is a follow-up to Bird Box.
Sequel.
It's a sequel. It's more or less a day in the life many years later, but the same, obviously, Mallory and Tom and Olympia, who, if you remember from both the book and the movie, are boy and girl, finally named Tom and Olympia. So they are now 16-year-olds, and Mallory, it's a day in the life with the three of them, essentially. A very scary day in the life, 16 or 12 years, I guess, after the first book ends.
If you've not read Josh's book, you should know he's been nominated for several awards. He's usually categorized in the genre of horror or thriller or suspense.
Haven't won any of those awards. Just wanted to note that.
No, but still.
Oh, for five. I'm in third place for the most nominations ever without winning in Stoker.
It's an honor just being nominated.
Well, that's, I have a card. So the guy that's in first place, this guy, Scott Edelman, this really funny guy. He has like a punch card because he was nominated, I think, 10 times and he's never won.
Wow.
So he now goes to, he goes to Stoker Cons, but he'll hand me, people who are in the running, these punch cards that are like, so you have five nominations and you haven't won. And on the card it says, it's an honor to be nominated.
But it kind of is though, right?
Well, yeah, sure it is. But, I still, God, I wish Bird Box would have won that one. It's funny. It's like, despite all this amazing stuff going on, and that's not saying Bird Box is any better than Maria Alexander is her name. And that's saying it's any better than her book. But God, that one felt like a special moment. And I was so prepared, Jeff. I was so overly prepared. It was like the tortoise and the hare.
Right.
Me at the awards ceremony.
Right.
I was like counting down the categories until I had to give a speech. I was like, okay, Allison, it looks like we got like three more categories and then I got to get up. And how's my collar look? Do I look good? I mean, it was like, I was like the hare.
Yeah. Folded paper in the suit pocket. You had a.
Yes. Okay. Like I'm like, drinking water to clear my throat. When they said, here's the announcement for best novel. I was like, a hand on the arm of the chair to stand up, all prepared, smile on my face. It didn't win. So, yeah.
I just think about how much brilliant work actor Al Pacino put in and wound up winning an Oscar for Scent of a Woman. And I hope that your book version of A Scent of a Woman performance isn't what actually gets it. I want your peak Malerman energy, not your later career hoo-ha stuff.
Not to
we'll
see where that goes, but not to whatever. But I do feel like something big coming lately. I was just talking to Allison about this recently. I don't know how to explain it. I don't, as an artist or something, you can start to gauge, like, because when you've made enough songs or books, you can start to gauge sort of a trajectory, you know, and you realize, like, you've had, you haven't peaked out. It's not like a single straight line or something, right? But you can see the peaks and valleys. And that doesn't mean the peaks are so high or that the valleys are so low, and someone else may disagree with you.
Right.
But I have a sense that something big is coming up next.
That gives me suspense right now. I don't want to ask further because I don't want to ruin it. But just in case no one knows who Josh Malerman is, we should go back to reference how nervous he was getting before his speech and then segue into how he's a musician in a band called The High Strung. And if you don't know The High Strung, but perhaps you're a Showtime viewer, then you've probably heard their song, providing the theme song for the show, Shameless. So for 10 years now, 9 years now.
Yeah, it's crazy.
9 consecutive seasons they've been using The High Strung, Detroit's own High Strung song.
Yeah, it's really, that is bananas for us, man. I remember we had just practiced, and I think I was still hanging out with Steven. And then
your guitarist?
Yeah, the guitarist of The High Strung, Steven Palmer. And then Derek Burke, the drummer, called me. He had just left practice, and he's like, this is crazy. This woman that shops our songs to film and TV called him and said that she got us a theme song on Showtime starring William H. Macy. And we were like, what? What are you talking about? And this is before the book stuff, too.
Right.
So, I mean, it would be exceptional either way, but, I mean, it was really something out of nowhere for us at that time.
Yeah, wild. Yeah. Wild. Let's get back to the book stuff.
Sure.
Because I want to ask specifically as a horror writer, and you've been writing all your life. You were, what, a little teenager, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you weren't little. Maybe
no,
you were
I
tall.
Was.
Okay, all right. But I wanna ask, first of all, do you feel like, I wonder if this is common in the experience of a horror writer, that you have to up the ante, that you have to get scarier, that you have to try something even further? It's almost like, are you building haunted houses on page?
Let's take, for example, A House at the Bottom of a Lake, right? Okay. This is about two teenagers who, on their first date, they're being creative, they go canoeing, and as they're canoeing, they pass over the roof of a house.
It's right? Like submerged 20 it's feet submerged, below them.
Yeah, yep. And they're like, wait, what is that? Is that a roof? And right. Is it just a floating roof? There can't be a house beneath this, right? Eventually, this leads to a house underwater, this sort of thing. While writing that book, I think all of us in the field think about what you just asked. You know, how do I need to ramp this up? Do I not? Is it so obvious? You know, there's always that danger of, and then, you know.
Where's
that
the kind scare? Of thing.
Right, and where's the scare? But sometimes I think that naturally some ideas, and I think Bird Box was like this too, I think some ideas are just frightening in and of themselves. So a house mom, like, you're down in this house. What more do you need than it's cold, it's dark, it's wet, it's unfamiliar, it's impossible, mm-hmm. and you're only able to see by the beam of your flashlight. How much scarier do you need than that? And at some point, if you're, and I think that it's important to be aware of that, like to be aware of how scary is Annie Wilkes mm-hmm. by herself rather than what she does, mm-hmm. right? How scary is, like, how dramatic of a thing does Pennywise have to do,
right?
He's scared, or Reagan, you right. know, how dramatic does it, if you think about it, she's in a bed the whole movie,
right?
Or most of the movie,
right?
And like at some point you realize, wait, this is scary. Where Reagan is scary. We don't need her. We don't then need the mom goes to brush her teeth, closes the bathroom mirror, and Reagan's standing in the shower. Rawr!
Right.
Right. It's scary enough. We got her. Like, we've reached scare. We've reached it. We got her in the bed, looking the way she is, saying the things she's saying.
Also,
and we don't necessarily have to ramp that up.
And she's, for me, scarier not when she's speaking in a Satan voice,
oh,
but
for
when
sure.
she's speaking in the mother voice of the priest. That's the scariest.
That's
part
the scariest
me.
For me
and
too.
And that's not the scary Satan
voice. Why do you
voice?
Do this to me, Demi? All that stuff. Yeah, that's the scariest stuff to
that's
me.
That
stuff haunted me as the first time I saw it. That stuff stuck with me a long time. Yeah.
let's go back to when you were younger and watching scary movies and having your mind warped, if that happened. And I especially want to ask, since this is a library podcast, Do you have any vivid memories or vivid experiences in libraries? You know, did you write in libraries? Did you go to your library? What was that like for you?
Yes, growing up. So I grew up in West Bloomfield, and I don't know if the library has changed. I don't know if it's changed locations since I was a kid. I doubt it. But I think the building itself has probably been updated through the years. But I definitely remember going there often with mom, et cetera. And then in college, I was in the library nonstop. Like, think about it, we didn't have Google. I don't know. So there was...
So the library was a gathering place.
Yes, in a big way, in terms of, but more, you know, more than just even reading. I mean, research, actual learning, if I wanted to find out about something. But my real experience, and you know this, my real experience with the library started with the band, when a librarian named Bill Harmer, who now is in Connecticut, by the way, when he approached us about playing, doing a tour of public libraries. His original vision was that it was going to be in Michigan. And at first, when he proposed this to me, I was a little nervous because he had just seen us play at a bar in Hamtramck, Smalls. Hey, I've got this idea. You guys do exactly what you just did in a library. And I'm like, what? You know, I'm picturing us singing like, jing, jing, read, you know. He's like, no, exactly what you just did. Stand on your amp. Your bass player's crazy. You know, we didn't even know him at that point, you know.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that sounds pretty cool. He's like, I would like to try the library as an all ages venue. Okay. So that led to, we said yes to that. And that led to some, I don't remember how many libraries in Michigan, let's say 2 dozen.
At least.
Something like that,
remember,
right?
Yeah. This is 2004.
I know. It's crazy to think of
this
that,
is,
man.
This is like, we, Kelly's right here, the producer. She started a music series here, live music, in 2010, 2009, you know?
Bill.
Getting loud in the library.
Bill worked at a radio station or a record store. And then, but he was also, and he is also real serious and committed to like libraries. And so I think that he was looking for a way of combining his two worlds. Mm-hmm. I really do. And then we, for some reason that night at the bar, we seemed to open that door for him. Uh-huh. So we did the 40, whatever it was. Now the number's 40, public libraries in Michigan.
I think it was 41, actually.
I think it was 40 something. Yeah, okay. We did the 50 libraries in Michigan.
Yeah.
And then Bill was like, you want to try this nationwide? Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, for a few years, we played something like 60 libraries a year in the summer months, usually.
NPR covered you. You were the library band.
Yep. And it was us in a Harry Potter theme band. So, but it was like, it was a weird thing because it's like you had to sort of explain Bill's philosophy every time it came up, which was, this is an all ages venue. We're not here. You know, we're not a vanilla, you know, like harmless band. In a way, I guess every band is, but it's like, we're not just here to like, you know, for little kids to like read. It's not reading
quiet
hour,
folk
right?
Music.
This is like, let's turn this into an all ages venue. And so, I thought it was an absolutely genius idea. I know it was. And then, I don't even remember exactly why that wound down. I think just after 3 or 4 years of it, it was like, all right, we did that. But that was an extreme experience with libraries. I mean, because every night we were meeting somebody who, you know, it was their job to, you know, set up these events,
right,
that sort of thing. Usually it was the head librarian in like a tiny town. Oh, it's another thing is that because these weren't traditional venues, we found ourselves in cities that bands would normally never go to and surrounding other like major cities, that kind of thing.
Your library is the place to find it.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. And that's what we're trying to talk about on this podcast, is how the definition of what a library can be evolves. You know,
oh yeah,
you can, if you want, come to your local library. This was your local library for 5 years, actually.
5 years, yeah.
You lived here in Ferndale. You can come to your local library and, let's say, blindfold a room of 60 people if you want.
Yeah.
You could do that, which brings us to our next experience in the library world for you. Is you were reading Bird Box here in 2015 because we were doing a citywide book club about it.
Yeah.
So sort of patting ourselves on the back.
That was amazing, man. And then also were you guys linked with Go Comedy?
Like, so Go Comedy across the street from us here at the library volunteered to do, improv sketches inspired by your book.
And then to think that was years before the movie, like three, four years before the movie. That is interesting I think they still call themselves the Bird Box Players.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very interesting from their perspective. So I went, I think it was every weekend for a month, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I went 3 out of 4 times. And I, of course, I was like out of my mind, loved it, you know? And I was like, this is crazy, you know? And then, but there was full houses there, mm-hmm. You know, and they were blindfolded. They couldn't go outside. They couldn't look. They made fun of like calling out, and there were scenes where they would go out in the audience blindfolded. This is like 3 or 4 years before Sandra Bullock plays Mallory.
Right.
And that's like an interesting.
Before the Twitter challenges.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. It's not like they were like capitalizing on something.
Right.
It was like you guys had like a book of the month. You know,
yeah, that's right.
The read of the month.
It was read of the month.
And they were like linked to that. And mm-hmm. they did something that in hindsight, you know, mm-hmm. seems like very, you know,
which
prescient.
Might answer my next question of what your favorite thing about living in Ferndale was. That kind of is it, right? That this is the place where that can happen.
Oh, you mean the town? Yeah.
Yeah. You were here from 2013-ish to 2018-ish.
Yeah. And yeah. Between you and Denny, you know Denny at the library bookstore?
Down the street from us, yeah. Downtown Ferndale.
You know him? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, 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 because he comes in here a lot, right?
I call him Dennis.
Yeah.
You can call him Denny.
Oh, you call him Dennis?
Yeah.
I see Denny like, or I used to see him like every single day. Yeah, to have you and him is sort of in the same town is like, Denny's probably the most knowledgeable horror sci-fi person I've ever even met. And that includes, you know, all these authors and conventions I've been to. That dude is an encyclopedia, man.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Let's get back to Bird Box becoming a movie and what that was like for you. I'm sure you've gotten a million interviews about that, but mm-hmm. now that you're 2 years beyond the experience, a year and a half beyond that experience, you know, can you still talk about how you had to process that? Specifically, how it blew up.
Yeah, I mean, I could give you like, and I will, I'll give you, why not? I'll give you mm-hmm. like a numbers example because it's more fun, I think. It's more interesting. So when Bird Box came out, it sold, I don't know, like 100 copies its first week, something like that. And then another 100 its second week, something like that. And it did that same steady number for about 4 years, which is somewhat astonishing. Mm-hmm. You have the initial run and it's either huge or small and maybe there's a peak or this or that along the way. But for whatever reason, that book stayed about exactly the same amount of sales it had every week for years. As it's the week it was released, this thing just kept like every week it would be like, oh, it sold like 100 and something or 90 something or 100 and something. And you're like, what is it's going on? It's like this very steady word of mouth. It wasn't like an explosion. It wasn't viral, but it also wasn't forgotten and it didn't like slip through any cracks. Mm-hmm. So the week that the preview came out with Sandra Bullock and all these actors and, you know, the book sold 300 copies that week and the publishing house called me and my agent and they were like, you know, we just want to let you know that this could be as big as it gets. I mean, we don't know. We just, you know, now the book title's everywhere. It's in all these ads and there's Sandra Bullock's face and
right.
And it sold 300 and that's pretty damn good. It spiked three times. And we were all like, there wasn't even a peep from my end, my team. There wasn't a peep of like, are you crazy? Brace yourself. None of that. We were like, oh, maybe you're right. Man, this might be it, but yeah. Who cares? This is all so exciting.
Right.
The first week that movie came out, Bird Box sold 20,000 copies.
I can't fathom that.
The first week.
Wow.
And this went on for like weeks. Oh my God. So imagine, now go back to, we're not even that much, you know, a month or so before that windfall. Mm-hmm. And again, me, my agent, who's all business, my manager who, you know, knows this business and, you know, predicts things all the time. My lawyer, who's been in a million scenarios, he reps the guy that wrote Cold Mountain and other stuff. So, I mean, none of us are like, oh, it's going to be more than 300 guys.
Sure.
You know, we're all like, yeah, okay, yeah, maybe this is it. Well, sure. That's pretty damn good.
Sure.
So that should underscore how unfathomably shocked we all were by what happened with this.
My favorite Bird Box joke is, who could have seen this coming? And if you haven't read it or seen the film, we're kind of spoiling that the characters cannot, for risk of their own life, look out of their own window. Something has befallen the earth, really, and there's something going on out there that we just can't look at, otherwise it'll drive us mad, so we have to wear blindfolds. Well, let's talk about a little bit about your other books and maybe talk about something, whether or not you do this consciously or not. Bird Box isn't a dystopia book, even if people think it might be.
I agree.
Black Mad Wheel isn't a war novel, even though it involves army soldiers and people might think it might be. Unburied Carol isn't a Western, even though people might perceive it to be. Do you consciously try to stay in that gray area where you're not really able to be pinned down?
Well, I gotta be honest. This is something that's like worried me through the years. The high strung I used to worry. I always worried like, we're too rock for the hippies, and we're too quirky for the punks, you know? We're too, and so I was worried about us falling into that same gray area. And I find myself now with novels, and I don't know if it has to do with the year 2014 to 19, like the era we're in, that audiences like want something that's like blurs those lines. Cause mm-hmm. it seems like I see a lot of articles online, what is horror now? Like, you know, and how elastic the genre is with what Jordan Peele has done and with Ari Aster and even The Witch, which is clearly a horror story, but is so slow and moody. And so I find myself like almost accidentally, or what's the right word? Like finally that gray area that I feel like I've always been in my life. Like in high school, I wasn't, you know, a popular kid, but I wasn't a nerd either. You know, I mean, I was like, you know, I've always been this sort of in between space. Like I'm like a tweener in all ways.
Right.
And so then somehow the books are like, there's like a space for that for me or something. Mm-hmm. And it's the first time that I've like, you know, I'm like, oh shoot, something I'm doing like actually belongs. And without, it's not like I ramped up the violence.
Right.
I'm like a hardcore badass now or something. Right. No. It's still, as you say, and I'm proud of that it is in this gray area.
Right.
But that's accepted right now. And that's like, that's even sought out right now in music too.
But at the same time, you also have to be careful. You don't want to ever allow yourself to be hemmed in by definition.
Right. Because
if you were like the horror master, then you'd have to like start going around wearing a cape with a snidely mustache and probably talking.
Both sound amazing.
And maybe carrying skulls in your knapsack or whatever. Or maybe you appeared, we should let people know that Josh refused to show up at the library unless he could have a smoke bomb and he would just appear out of the ether. That was how he had to do it.
That'd be amazing if I was just back here. Like you guys were walking by and I'm just sitting here like, hi.
Right, and you appear.
Just waiting and it's like foggy in here.
You thought I was joking earlier when I told you we were going to pour pig's blood on you at the end of this, so.
No, I'm ready. I'm ready.
But you know what I mean? There are those tropes, right?
Yeah.
We're just joking on horror tropes. You don't want to be
I guess not. You know, I think that David Robert Mitchell and Ari Aster and all these guys would probably say this. Jordan Peele would probably say the same thing, that they don't want that either. But at the same time, oh my God, I'm like, I have fully embraced the genre for sure.
Sure.
You know, mostly I've been on a strict horror diet for, 20 years. It's terrible for my skin. But I there's a million aspects that like I'm into the genre, but I'm very careful that, you know, when I read, cause there's a lot of stuff out there that is like really like violent and mm-hmm. and not supernatural violence even, like where you're just like, why am I even reading this?
Yeah.
You know? And then I'm very careful not to be like, okay, well, this sells.
Right.
You know? And like, no. Let's just keep leaning or being excited, thrilled by these, as you say, gray area ideas.
Right.
And let's just roll with that. I think the finest example of what genre was it is The Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm.
It so much can go back to that. The stable of writers, Bradbury, Beaumont, Matheson, William Nolan. I mean, it's crazy that the stable that was writing for that show, that crew and that guy, like there's a lot of people who relate to, like guys my age who relate to the Beats
mm-hmm.
or relate to, you know, like the Clash, like the punks, that kind of thing. But those dudes, the Twilight Zone writers is the crew that I relate to.
Yeah.
And they were writing in that gray area for sure.
And since we're in a library and talking about books, if you've never watched The Twilight Zone, maybe start with Time Enough at Last.
Yeah.
Starring Burgess Meredith.
Yeah.
Where he wants nothing to do but to read books. You know, what's also interesting about that is, yeah, you don't want to get preoccupied with the thrill or preoccupied with the violence or whatever. And if you're preoccupied with anything, it seems like it's the search. A lot of your characters and a lot of your books are on a progression or going somewhere or looking for something. They're looking for a house in the water.
Yeah.
They're looking for safety in Bird Box. You have this interesting, two characters are on almost a chase throughout. My favorite of yours, Unbury Carroll. And there's a search for the truth in Inspection. There's a lot of searching going on in your books.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think you're the only person that's ever pointed that out to me. And the river is the trail.
Right.
Is the desert.
Josh is looking for something.
I don't know what I'm looking for, but I know I want it to be big and I just want it to be so scary. I have a whole list of ideas. I text myself every single idea because, you know, like Mitch Hedberg has this joke that he's in bed and if he comes up with a joke, he either has to write it down or he has to convince himself that it's not that funny. And so with every idea I have, I'm like, don't even ask whether or not it's good or bad. Write it down. So I have this like master list, but that can start to become daunting, you know, when there's a list of like 20 stories or 30 stories and you really actually want to write every single one of them, you know?
Yeah.
But sometimes I wonder, because I think you would agree, maybe you wouldn't, is that, I mean, you could take like a book like Mrs. Dalloway, right?
She'll buy the flowers herself.
And, right. And it's and everyone said, this is the book that split the atom. And it's like, if I just told you, if Virginia Woolf was here and told us what Mrs. Dalloway is about, we'd be like, oh, that sounds really good. Oh, let's see, whatever. But it's like, obviously, it's all how it's done, right?
Right.
So, and Catcher in the Rye, the same thing. What's it about? Oh, well, it's about this unsettled youth. And anyway, what, you got anything more thrilling?
Right.
And it's the most thrilling, you know, soul-rattling book ever.
Right.
So with that list, it's very, I try not to just like rattle, you know, go down, okay, man buys a hunting online. Okay, man, you know, wakes up, he has no feet. You know, it's like actually stop at each idea and try to imagine like how can it be done. That would be something like give each little dinky idea its due.
Man.
Give the dinky idea its due. And that's like.
Well, that's a professional term.
Yeah,
those are your text messages to yourself.
It's true.
That makes me curious, like, there's got to be a different way that you would approach if you're writing lyrics for the high strung. And
well, just recently, so last night I watched classic albums, Rumours.
Oh,
Fleetwood Mac. It was mind blowing. If you guys haven't seen that, it's on Amazon Prime, that classic album stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Watch that episode. It's going to blow your mind.
Okay.
And at one point, Christy McVie was saying that she's reached a point now in her life where she has to write lyrics first. And I totally agree. And forever, when we were younger, it was just like, oh, this is an exciting melody, da 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 da, and then the chord changes. Oh, man, that's great. Now I got to sing something. But now you reach a certain point where you're like, I don't want to just sing something. I want these to be great, even if it's just, I love you the best, better than all the rest. Like, I just want to make sure that that's straight first before we sing it, just nothing, you know?
That's interesting.
Yeah, so
that also happened over the last 6 years?
Mm-hmm.
Correlating with your author life?
Maybe. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You know, we're in the Ferndale Library here once again, and we're very excited that people are listening to this podcast. We are nearing the 10-year anniversary of this building being renovated and reopening.
Wow.
And your band played here.
Wow.
For the kickoff party.
Wow. 2009? Or no, it was 2010.
Yeah, it would have been May of 2010.
Yeah. Wow.
August of 2010. That's why we had the producer here, Kelly.
Thank
in
you.
The studio with us.
I planned.
That was Kelly's event.
But you were here.
No, but that's unbelievable.
Oh,
holy
yeah.
cow. Mm-hmm. It still feels all of a piece to me. I don't know how to explain that. Like,
you've mentioned that with the band. It's like it's not.
I don't know what it is. I feel that way with age. I feel that way with relationships. Mm-hmm. Even though when I met Allison 7 years ago, somehow it still feels like, and then everything obviously changed dramatically when you fall in love, right?
Right.
But even with that, and even with the books, and even with the movie Bird Box, and even with all this stuff, and all these gargantuan changes, it still all feels like of a piece to me.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. That means you can manage it psychologically.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason why is I think that my personal reality is tethered to writing. Mm-hmm. So if you're always writing, and that's sort of your anchor, right? Mm-hmm. Then anything that happens to you or for you or anything that you do or decisions you make are all still tethered to that idea. I'm writing novels. That thrill, whatever, hasn't changed an iota.
It also grounds you.
That's what I mean. I think that it kind of grounds you. And I also think that this Bird Box stuff happening, which I'm insanely grateful and happy for.
Sure.
It happening when I'm in my 30s and 40s. Because I got a book deal when I was 37.
Right.
I think that also goes a long way in it not rattling the foundation. If this had gone on when I was like 23 or something.
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah.
I can't say in a family friendly, you know.
Well, sure. Sure.
I would be doing with all my money. No, I'm just kidding.
Imagine.
But it's just like I don't even know where I would be psychologically at 23 if this was going on then, dude.
It's probably good to remind yourself, even if there's like a hot air balloon with your face on it. And fireworks and who knows what. And
let's say that was happening. I would, at this, when I was 23, I'd be like, woohoo.
Woohoo, and spend your money.
Now it's like, I would be like, oh, that dude writes every day.
Right. Defining yourself as, okay, well, that's great. There's a big old hot air balloon and fireworks, and I'm a writer. That's all well and good.
Yep. And I have a sense that the, you know,
the writers who, someone like Hemingway is different than someone like Stephen King, who like just, it's just different. It's almost like Hemingway created a character also, mm-hmm. you, even without doing quite like what Bob Dylan did or something, but there's still a sense that he did that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then I don't know if he, you know, for a guy like him, and it also for him, he had a different type of success and when he was younger. I wonder what that did to him. He was still able to put out like, holy cow, work throughout his whole life. I mean, I think Old Man and the Sea is his last book, right? Mm-hmm. And that's arguably his best. Mm-hmm. So I think about that often, how some of these guys and girls, how do you maintain, like, the world anoints you the greatest band, Beatles, when in 1964, and then you go on to do the greatest albums ever?
Right.
Like, where did you find that resolve with all that, like, bizarre pressure and attention? And it's interesting.
It's a steel focus.
It really is. It has to be. And I think Hitchcock was like that. I think Stephen King is for sure like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not just output. I mean, that's definitely a part of it. But it's also, there's a sense of like life, like vivacity in what they're putting out, mm-hmm. you know?
Was there any pressure to adapt? And by that, I mean going to a short story format and knowing that you would be maybe writing for the screen. I'm referring to, you wrote an episode for the rebooted Creepshow.
Yeah.
Which is on the streaming service Shudder. And that involves Greg Nicotero.
Yeah.
Of Walking Dead fame. What was that experience like?
That was amazing. So one of the producers, Brian Witten, reached out to me and asked if, and I had met Brian in LA to talk about other projects once. And he, a couple times, and he wrote me about, do you have any short stories or anything that could work for Creepshow? And I was like, wait, I love Creepshow. And I started telling him all about, as I've told you, how much I love the soundtrack and the movie and all this. And then, which is my style, I was like, why don't I send you? I sent him like 10 stories or something. I was like, one of these got to work, man, you know? And then him and Greg Nicotero called me and that they wanted to buy two of them.
Okay.
So House of the Head was one. And this is an interesting thing real fast. I don't know what floor it is in the DIA that has like the African art, like the old stuff. Is it the first floor?
I want to say it's the first and if not the ground floor.
Yeah, I think it's, okay.
Yeah.
So in there, and I don't know if it's still there, there was this like little wooden something, like mask or something, and it was called the House of the Head. Oh. Allison and I were in the DIA, this is years ago now, and I was like, wait, the house, what does that even mean? It's like this little mask, like, you know, or something like that. And then I was like, this is the greatest title ever. Allison, I got to write this story. I got to write. And she's like, you know, or I don't know what she said, but I was like, I don't want it to take place in a museum. I just want that title. Mm-hmm. I went home and wrote the story and it has nothing to do with the DIA, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, they say that they wanted to make that one. And then my manager, Ryan, asked them, you know, if I could write the script. And they said, yeah. And I was a little nervous because. Yeah.
Interior, day, bedroom.
It's like, oh God, I don't know if this is like natural for me. But so you're all excited for the gig, mm-hmm. right? You're like, oh my God, I'm doing something for Creepshow. They wanted, this is unbelievable. And then you're like, oh, this better be good.
Is there anything else I think you could tell us? Mallory is coming out in May of 2020.
Yep.
And maybe,
I am freaking thrilled about that book right now. I'll just tell you real, is there a time limit on these? Is there you guys got all day?
We'll just cut you off.
Okay.
You just go.
So I wrote Mallory a draft of it in February where I just bolted through it. And the reason why was I recognized what was going on with Bird Box and that there may be a tension for another story in this world. And I had a thread that I had removed from the rough draft of Bird Box that there just wasn't room for it, I guess, that made the book about twice as long, really. So I was like, oh, I'm going to use that. What if I use that thread in a different setting, but it's still Mallory, but years later? This is great, because then it also felt like the original idea came from the same pool, all this stuff. So I wrote it in like a flurry. I think it was 15 days or something. Gave it a rewrite, sent it into the... Oh, then people are, you know, talking, hey, we would like another... You know, Del Rey is asking for a follow-up, possibly.
Good Lord.
And I'm like, well, here it is.
That's like 18 pages a day.
Yeah, it was.
Like 20 pages a day.
It was like 18, 20... It was like 20 pages a day or something. And so then... So then they were like, we are interested in a second. I'm like, great, I got one for you, you know? And I felt really like, whew, got past, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen possibility, all that kind of thing. Problem is, there was something just inherently, what's the right word? Just, I don't know how to say this, like not Bird Boxian. I don't know how to say it. It just didn't seem like gelled. Mm-hmm. And they liked it and they gave me notes. I rewrote it. They gave me notes again. I rewrote it. They gave me a line edit, dude. That is line by line for 300 pages edit. And I said, and that's like the last step normally. Mm-hmm. I mean, because now we're down to the nitty gritty. Like, right. You know, your word echo and this, now we're not talking about structure. And I was like, thank you for making this line edit. It probably took you like a month to do this, but can I start from scratch? Write a whole different, just a whole different book. I was like, throw me the ball again. I'm going to get a hold of it this time.
Oh my gosh.
And she was, without missing a beat, she was like, okay.
Wow.
And I was like, are you serious, Trisha? She's amazing, this editor, Trisha Narawani. And I was like, are you sure? And you just spent like a month and we've been working on this for months, you know? And she's like, yeah, go for it. And I did. And it's awesome.
Yeah, my God.
And she's like, oh my God, this is so much better. It's just so much richer, so much more fun. It really focuses on Mallory and Tom and Olympia. And whereas in the other one, it seemed like they were three of a cast of characters, you mm-hmm. know, but then there was the setting up of these other characters and this world building. It just did not feel like the right thing at all. And it's interesting to me because in a couple ways, number one, I'm a numbers guy, as you know, and I keep like steady track of how many books I've written, that kind of thing. So books number 29 and 31 are Mallory. That's interesting to me. What's ever going to happen to that other Mallory? Mm-hmm. Nothing. But
right.
It's just interesting to me that this other version just exists.
Right.
I don't know if I have another example. I know that when Ken Kesey wrote Cuckoo's Nest, he finished it and then said, what if this was told from Chief's perspective?
Oh man.
And it changed the world really.
Yeah.
But I don't like, that's different than what I went through. Mine was like, you know what? Screw it. Whole new story. Let's try it again.
Story, yeah.
Right. But I don't know if I have another example of a book. I don't know. I've never heard of an author did that necessarily. I'm sure it's been done.
Yeah.
But I just don't know of that. Like, I don't know of that with, like, you know, anyone in the genre or outside the genre or anything like that.
Yeah. But I guess there was that pressure, I guess, to be Bird Boxian.
You know, there was a sense. And then it struck me like, wait, why? There are... characteristics of this world or of this book, of the book Bird Box, there are characteristics of this that are like fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like why did it have to be so different?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't it be similar in these few ways? And then everything just like exploded from there. So
before I let you go, I should let people know, you mentioned books 29 through 30. Yes, you put out a book in 2014, you were published, but you've been writing books since you were 17 years old.
Yeah.
You've got manuscripts galore.
Yep. So, my office is insane right now. I need a second crate. I have filled up the writing crate. And that may sound like, well, you've been writing forever. Of course you have. But actually go get like a crate, like a crate this big. And like you realize it's thousands of pages to fill that thing.
Right.
You don't, it doesn't look like it. But when you start to fill it, you're like, dude, I've written like 10 books and this is only half full.
Mm-hmm.
Like that kind of thing. If you guys have a crate here or something that I could have.
Yeah, and I think that's just important to note. You weren't some like fly-by-night sudden success author who just popped up in the world in 2014.
I've had some friends tell me that because of Bird Box that at their jobs or whatever, a coworker will be like, "Oh, I heard that my bandmates told me this. Oh, I heard I heard Josh from your band, you know, wrote a book and it was successful. I'm going to write a book now, you know." And then Steven's like, well, I mean, no, do it, but
sure.
but he didn't just write a book on a whim, you know."
Right.
Yeah.
And
but I would never discourage anyone from doing that, just saying.
One of my favorite things about Josh's time as a resident of Ferndale, he's since left, but we're going to claim him as our own forever. But he was a constant, and this is for anyone out there listening, he was a constant library visitor. And it's not like he necessarily checked things out. You would come here with dime store paperbacks, some what sometimes would look like pretty trashy stuff. But in the horror genre,
yeah.
And you would just post up and read.
Yeah.
You remember that?
I love this place, man.
This was the place for that.
I wrote here, too. I wrote, I'm trying to remember what book it was. There was one that I wrote here a few sessions with.
But you found this place to be, I don't want to put words in your mouth. You found this place to be a...
Oh, yeah. No, it's like, in terms of like writing and in terms of, because like Allison, right, as an artist needs like canvas and space and be a mess, right?
Right.
But in terms of being a writer, like I like to be around people that are working.
Right.
Or that are just like engaged, put it that way, mm-hmm. rather than a coffee shop setting. So like the first book I wrote, Wendy, was at a coffee shop, but it was like all law school students. And they were all, I mean, I would come, it was a 24-hour joint. And I would come and they were like all nose in their books. And it was like, all right, let's get to work.
Right.
And there's a sense, the library is not so stringent like that, but there is also a sense here of like, you're here, let's just get to work, let's do it.
Yeah.
And like, to me, that sort of, that motivates me to be around that element.
I mean, we're biased because we work here and we love libraries, but you know, this is the place where the community comes and then suddenly there's a calmness.
Yep. 100%.
You know, a sense of
calm. As if this place was built on quartz or something.
But anyway, I'm very grateful that you could be here today, Josh Malerman. This has been a pleasure. And this has been the premiere episode of A Little Too Quiet.
I loved it. Thank you both so much.
Oh, of course. And so if you're hearing this now, we're a few months out from May of 2020 when Mallory will be coming out for Josh Malerman's follow-up to Bird Box. I want to thank him for being here. I want to thank you for listening. This has been A Little Too Quiet, which is the Ferndale Library podcast brought to you by the Friends of the Ferndale Library with delightful music that you're listening to right now by John Duffy, a local musician of the band Pato y Pato. Thanks to my producer, Kelly Bennett, here on the knobs and dials. And my name is Jeff Milo. Stay tuned for more episodes, including some history of the Ferndale Library and more author interviews, such as with Michael Zadorian. So find us on iTunes and Spotify. Please give us a rating so you can help us reach other listeners. We're going to let you go for now, but tune in again soon.